Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
You guys know who Philo Farnsworth was?
Philo Farnsworth.
Yeah.
What's going on?
He invented television. I don't mean he invented television like Uncle Milty. I mean he invented the television in a little house in Provo, Utah, at a time when the idea of transmitting moving pictures through the air would be like me saying I figured out a way to beam us aboard the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah, look, I...
He was a visionary. He died broke and without fanfare. The guy I really liked, though, was his brother-in-law, Cliff Gardner. He said, Philo, I know everyone thinks you're crazy, but I want to be a part of this. I don't have your head for science, so I'm not going to be able to help much with the design and the mechanics of the invention, but it sounds like you're going to need glass tubes.
JJ, I don't
You see, Philo was inventing the cathode receptor, and even though Cliff didn't know what that meant or how it worked, he'd seen Philo's drawing, and he knew he was going to need glass tubes. And since television hadn't been invented yet, it's not like you could get them at the local TV repair shop. I want to be a part of this, Cliff said. I don't have your head for science. How would it be if I were to teach myself to be a glass blower and I could set up a little shop in the backyard and I could make all the tubes you'll need for testing? There ought to be congressional medals for people like that.
Maybe so.
I've looked over the notes you've been giving over the last year or so, and I have to say they exhibit an almost total lack of understanding of how to get the best from talented people.
Excuse me, but...
You said before that for whatever reason I seem to be able to exert some authority around here. I assure you, it's not because they like me. It's because they knew 2 minutes after I walked in the door, I'm someone who knows how to do something. I can help. I can make glass tubes. That's what they need. One last thing. The first and last decision-making authority on this show will rest with Isaac Jaffe until Isaac Jaffe says otherwise. And if you disrespect him in my presence again, I will rededicate the rest of my life to ruining the rest of yours. And if you think I'm just mouthing at you, you should ask around about me. I have absolutely no conscience about these things.
Minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of August, in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, the place from which all goodness and light derives, humanity's last bright, shining hope. My name is Rick Emerson. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's Wednesday. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us today and be part of our radio program. It's 503-505-6964. The confluence of all great things there at the beginning of the show. A little, it's William H. Macy reading dialogue by Aaron Sorkin about Philo Farnsworth. There you go. Bam! That's what I'm talking about. That's how you start a show. That's how you begin something right there. All right. It's 503-505-6964. If you would like to engage with us telephonically, you can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached at don@rickemerson.com. That is D-A-W. Basically, anybody you want to reach with the show, it's just their name at rickemerson.com. Just for convenience purposes. Not like I need to hear my own name all the time here on the Rick Emerson Show on the Emerson News Network. If there was a way to make a phone number so it was like 5 Emerson or something, I would have done that too. Let's just be honest. This is like when here's the difference between me and Oprah. The one and only difference. The only thing that separates Oprah and myself. I remember they were talking to her about O Magazine. And you know how she's on the cover of every issue. And I don't mean that figuratively. You know, like every time I turn on the news, there's something about, you know, the recession. I mean, she's literally on the cover of every issue. I mean, she's the only person that's ever been on the cover, her and her dog, I think. And they asked her why. They said, Oprah, you know, there's There's 6 billion people in the world. What? Why are you on the cover of every issue? And she did that thing where she, first of all, she put on the accent that she does when she wants to be one of the common folk, where she begins everything with, well, let me tell you. But she just said, well, we just couldn't think of anything else, and so we just went with me until a better idea comes along. Which is, I mean, I guess sort of great in the sense that it's just such an obvious lie that she had no problem just saying right to the camera. So, you know, I'm not even going to lie about that. It's just, you know, when in doubt, I just use my own name for everything. All right, well, in any event, it's 503-505-6964. You can email it as Rick or Dawn at rickemerson.com. The chat box is open as well. You go to rickemerson.com, the website there. And a couple of things. First of all, you go to the rickemerson.com website. You should click on the Rick Emerson Show link there. And you'll see the text box link there on the right-hand side. Basically, it gives you all the contact information. Somebody's like, how do I get in touch with you this way? You go, there's a whole thing that just has all the information. There's a thing in the live chat. You click it, you're good to go. Also, last night, and or this morning, it all kind of blends together after a while. I put up a sort of an overview of the Emerson Grant, which we were talking about yesterday and today during Legion of News, and then mentioned it again. But it's courtesy of our friends at New Millennium Maintenance. They are offering you, I mean, maybe not actually you, sort of a figurative you, kind of a generalized collective you. It's probably not going to be you. I mean, the law of averages says it's almost certainly not going to be you, but who knows? It's good to have dreams. The point is, 10 times a month, 10 lucky souls, though. 10 lucky souls per month will receive a one-month subscription to this radio program. And you're asking yourself, well, I'm already listening. Here's the thing. You're listening, but you probably know some guy, some wretch who's not able to afford it.
Or some lady.
Or some lady. Well, I mean, wretch is a gender-neutral term. I know female wretches, as do we. I'm just saying, you probably know somebody who either A, doesn't know that the show is, you know, has returned and is back and available. B, you know, I'm not insensitive to the fact that these are difficult, trying times for everybody. So, you know, is not able to, you know, make the $7 a month. I understand that. That happens. Or they just, and this is the more likely explanation, they are just unaware of the unabashed glory that is the Rick Emerson radio program. They know not of the penis watch. I mean, really, and it's, you know, it's a busy world. Not everybody can keep track of everything. I understand this. But if you have said to yourself, my God, if only he could hear the program for 1 month, his whole life would change for the better. That could actually happen. So you go to rickemerson.com. You should read the whole thing about the Emerson Grant. Basically, the upshot is this. You make a YouTube video, no more than 2 minutes in length, and you send us the link. In the video, you explain why you or somebody you know ought to receive an Emerson Grant. And if you are selected, 1 month subscription shall be yours or that person's. So you find out more at rickemerson.com. I want to thank our friends at New Millennium Maintenance who make that possible. So there you go. Find out more about that. Coming up later on today, Ms. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be here in the studio. We'll talk about a few different things. First of all, she's got a, I guess there's some big, I don't really understand what's going on with this story as such, but I know that there's some whole something or other going on with the kombucha tea, like, industry. And I don't really know what the scandal there is. I guess this is one of the, you know, and kombucha's that tea where you make, but you just get a bunch of fungus and you stick it in a jar until it turns into liquid and then hippies drink it, I guess. I mean, I don't really know much beyond. All I know is that if you open any cupboard in my home, you're going to see just basically a jar full of scum. And then later, if you hang around long enough, you'll see my wife come in and pour the scum into a glass and drink it. And I don't understand why. I mean, apparently it's good, but here's the thing. I'm never going to find out because I'm never going to drink it. But it is but it's not just a thing that, like, hippies make at home. Like, you can go to the store and you can buy it now. Bottles of I mean, I don't call it scum as such, but you know what I mean. Anyway, so I guess a lot of people out of state, companies from outside of Oregon have been making it, but something about it, there's some sort of contamination, or they pull it off the shelves, or something has gone wrong, and so there's an upheaval in the local scum-selling industry.
So there's been some kind of a health problem with the tea that is made from fermented mold.
And here's the thing, apparently...
That's shocking.
Apparently here was the nature of the problem. If you left it on the shelf long enough, I'm not making this up, it just turned into booze. Which it seems like that would actually then be a selling point. Like that would make it almost like something you might want to ingest.
Yeah, hippies don't want to have fun.
No, they don't. Anyway, so we'll talk to Kelly Clark about that later on. So that's that is coming up later on in today's program. Let's see. What else? We got a taser watch on the way. Religious nutcase watch on the way. And I have a corpse watch over here that we may or may not have time to get to. So we'll... I actually just got that sent to me. So we'll get to that here in just a few. Oh, I've also got...
Right here.
I don't know if it's a Darwin watch. It sort of is, but it kind of goes beyond that. It's sort of a Darwin watch plus. At the core of it is a Darwin watch, but then it becomes so much more. So much more that I'm going to set it aside into its own segment. We'll get to that later on as well.
I'm intrigued.
Are you? Have I done my job effectively?
I've
aroused your interest. Don Taylor is working on the following stories for you on this Wednesday.
Portland fighter jets scrambled over Seattle for President Obama. A doctor freezes a man's skull to save his life.
Excellent.
And a dinosaur is decapitated in Norman, Oklahoma.
Okay. And so there you go. All right. It's 503-505-6964. Hold on. Let me have a swig of crisp, refreshing Fizzo here. Just 1 second. I had to do the emergency stop-up this morning. It was that thing where, because what I'll do is later in the evening, I will sometimes drink, not a whole one, because I'm not a crazy man, but sometimes in the evening, like let's say around 9 or 10, I'll have a half a Fizzo. And it's only because I am just such a caffeine junkie at this point that it's not even going to keep me awake. It just keeps the withdrawal at bay. It just keeps me evened out. You know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
It just keeps me on an even keel. So I put down the last half of a Fizzo this morning. Had half last night, and then this morning I wake up. And here's the irony, by the way. See, again, I'm misusing irony, but the thing is, it's almost like the correct usage of that word has been beaten out of me by an idiotic society. I almost don't even remember how to use it correctly anymore.
And yet you keep hammering on that less fewer thing.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, the other thing is, like, I don't know how to do the she and me.
Mm.
And I know there's a whole trick that I'm not going to bother to learn.
Yeah, if you would use either I or me in the sentence without the other person,
I know,
then that's how you're supposed to say it.
I know. I know that.
But it usually just sounds wrong.
But the thing is, it's not even that. It's that. Now we're getting sidetracked. But here's the reason about the I and me thing. Because people have pointed out that I do that incorrectly. Here's the reason why I do the she and me went to the mall, or she and Dawn and me, or Dawn and I went to the mall, whatever. I know the method for figuring out which is correct. But the thing is, it's not one of those things I can do on the fly. Less and fewer, I can figure out on the fly. Usually, lay, lie, lied, lane, that whole thing, I can figure that out just as I'm talking. The she and me, she and I, Dawn and me, Dawn and I, whatever, that's the thing. I have to stop and think about it. And it's just, and then so basically I'm going, so anyway, and then there's a thing where the processor in my head starts grinding. Anyway, so I don't worry about that. What was my point? So I went to, I was done to my last half Fizzo today. And this sort of thing that's like irony is that I was consuming it last night while I was sitting there watching Breaking Bad, which is, of course, about a guy who's just dealing speed. And there's this whole sad, gripping arc where a guy's becoming a junkie, of course. And I'm just, you know, I'm sitting there going, well, it would suck to be a junkie as I'm opening the top of my Fizzo at 10 o'clock at night. Oh, sweet, refreshing, you know, nectar of life. Make the spiders get off me. Oh, that's better. So I had to go by the plaid pantry this morning, and they must know at this point that I'm some sort of an addict. And I come in with that crazed sort of the Fizzo's here, right? You got the good stuff, huh? It's in the back? All right, thanks. Okay, and I had to go back there and, you know, shoving my pennies under the counter. So this is a trip that I would imagine you have made at some point in your life.
Well, yeah, and actually this morning it was my every other day Fizzo restocked because, of course, right now they have them 2 for $3. But if you only buy them one at a time, it's $1.79. And I am cheap and poor. So it's like I wait 2 days, then I buy two at once, and then I keep one in the fridge. And I was at the plaid pantry this morning buying my two Fizzos. And had a very nice conversation with the woman who worked there. I feel this sort of, you know, empathy for people who work at Plaid Pantry, because that's got to be just a terrible place to work.
Yes.
I've had some terrible jobs, but working at any Plaid Pantry, it's a terrible, terrible place to work. And the woman at my Plaid Pantry told me this morning that she just worked 8 days straight, but that this was her last day at the Plaid Pantry, so that was okay. I congratulated her on this.
She wasn't fired. She's moving on.
No, she's moving on to something else. Congratulated her on this, assuming, as I said to her, obviously she must be moving up to something better than the Plaid Pantry. And she said, no, I'm going someplace where the people will be even creepier and crazier. And I never actually got a chance to find out where exactly this place was.
Didn't you? How could you not have just said, was there somebody behind you in line? How could you not have just said, like, where's that?
Well, what happened was I did a take, I think, and I was like, worse than Plaid Pantry? And that just led us to having this whole conversation about the whole nature of working at Plaid Pantry and how, And we were commiserating over the fact that we are out in the burbs in Tualatin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a pretty darn nice plaid pantry comparatively. And I said, oh, yeah. And she said her first plaid pantry job was her very first night was the graveyard shift at like 181st and Powell or something like that.
Yeah, no.
And it's like I can't remember if that was the exact address, but it's the only one that apparently actually has like bulletproof, Lexon.
Where you're behind
behind glass so they can't.
Can I get some cigarettes, please?
Yeah. So we talked about, and I told her that I lived in North Portland for 10 years before I moved to Tualatin. So and she goes, oh, yeah, you know then. I'm like, oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, these people don't know from a bad, from crazy plaid pantry.
I'm wondering what job has a crazier clientele than plaid pantry.
I don't know, unless she's, like, working at the welfare office or something.
I was going to say, unless she's going to work at, like, she's working at an institution of some
Maybe
kind.
Maybe at the parole board or something. I have no idea.
Maybe,
I should have asked. Damn.
No, there's nothing comes to mind.
I
what is the worst job you've ever had?
Wow. I did have a bunch of really terrible temp jobs. I worked at a temp agency, but I didn't type fast enough at the time.
Really?
To do really like dignified clerical work. So they sent me to warehouses. But since I wasn't a big burly guy, I got these weird warehouse jobs like... one job, I spent the entire day sitting at a table with a bunch of Mexican ladies, and we collated computer manuals.
What is that? Hold on. When people say collating, what does that mean?
It basically means stacking. It means, you know, stacking up chapter one with chapter two with chapter three, putting it in the notebook.
Okay, so it's sorting into a complete work.
Right.
Okay, all right.
And then we had a little portable TV that we watched soap operas all day while we put together computer manuals.
That's adorable.
And then I had another job through the same agency where I went to work at a plexiglass display case factory where they made, like, those plexiglass display cases for, like, Varnay sunglasses that sit on the countertops and stuff. And they gave me no training or no information on anything. They would just point and say, go do this. Go stack that. Go do something. And at one point, they handed me a blowtorch and said, okay, when all of the big sheets of plexiglass come off of the saw, and they're also, you got to run the blowtorch across the end to get the saw marks off. But they didn't. And then the guy just walked away. So I used this blowtorch and then ran it across the back of my thumb. And then no one knew where the first aid kit was.
I'm not laughing at you. I really am.
No, and so I've had some terrible jobs.
That's hilarious. Don't take this the wrong way, but on the list of people to whom I would not just give a blowtorch and walk away, you're like the first five. I mean...
Here you go.
Seriously. Let me now turn my back on you. Oh, my God almighty.
I also had a job for a while. I worked in an information booth at Los Angeles International Airport where I had to sell tickets for the Super Shuttle. And
what's the Super Shuttle?
Well, Super Shuttle, they don't actually have booze at the airport anymore, but they still have Super Shuttle.
Right.
It's a van service, shuttle van service. And they used to, like, you could buy tickets at the airport, and they would take you to different parts of L.A. That the thing is that you would have to share the van with other people,
right.
But it was cheaper than a taxi.
Right.
And it would be like if you worked at the international terminal, for example, like Japanese businessmen would walk up and they'd slam their rolling suitcases against the side of the thing and stick their faces up to the hole and yell, hurry, woo, hurry, woo. You know, and it was just that was a pretty terrible job.
Oh, I love this show. All right. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. I'm just going to start saying hurry woo all the time and never explain what it means to anybody.
One of the guys I worked with, whenever one of the Japanese businessmen would do that, he had a stock response. The guy would yell, hurry woo, hurry woo. And he'd just put his face down to the window and yell, $20, $20, right back at the guy.
Awesome. All right, then. It's 505. I mangled that right out of the gates. 503-505-6964. Kelly Clark, phone line will be coming up later on. Taser Watch. Religious Nutcase Watch on the way. We may or may not get up this sort of this Super Darwin Watch. We have that installment of today's Pop Culture Authority. Pop Culture Authority for today will answer the question, why aren't porn films prostitution? If you make a porn film, why aren't you, in fact, a hooker and a John and busted as being such? So Don Taylor will answer that question later on today and so forth. And a whole stack of things. And I've got a top five. I don't even know that I want to tease it because we may or may not even have time to get to it. So I got a top five sitting right here that we'll endeavor to get to later on. But I'm not going to say anything more about it because then if we don't get it, done, then, you know, I don't want you to be just filled with, you know, with sadness and a sort of, you know, bereft, sullen feeling. All right, it's 503-505-6964. Without further ado, ladies and gentlefolk, please make way for Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
You read those now!
Military fighter jets were scrambled to respond to an airspace violation near Air Force One in Seattle, causing sonic booms that were heard from Longview to Seattle. North American Aerospace Defense Command spokesman John Cornelio said the F-15 jets were sent from the 142nd Fighter Wing in Portland after a report that an aircraft violated the restricted airspace. He said the aircraft left the restricted area before the Air National Guard jets arrived. Colonel Michael Stinsell of the 142nd said the two F-15s took off from PDX, made an immediate right turn to the north, going straight to afterburners. That put the jets faster than the speed of sound, creating the sonic boom. They took off at 1:38 p.m., went as far north as Payne Field in Everett, placed into a holding pattern for a bit, and were back in Portland about 2:45 and 2:50.
I'm sorry, is there a place called Payne Field?
Payne Field.
Is that one word or two?
It's two words.
All
Payne.
Right.
It's named after someone whose name is Payne with an E on the end.
Oh, okay. That's less interesting. Yeah. I thought it was like Potter's Field or something, but it was where they'd
the
take you and just...
Field of Payne.
It was, you know, it was, take, yeah, it was like
it's
a place
like
where
Onion Field.
It was like a place where you'd be taken and re-educated a little bit or possibly just killed.
The float plane pilot landed on Lake Washington at Kenmore and was greeted by Secret Service agents. He and his female passenger were returning home after a weekend at Lake... How is that? Chelan.
Yeah.
They reported they saw jets as they flew between Seattle area and the mountains. Once the plane landed, the pilot and his passenger were interviewed by the Secret Service.
Yes, I imagine they were interviewed with batons. They have occasionally, you know, my hometown of Kennewick, there's the nuclear reactors there and whatnot. That's a place you can't fly over. If you fly over the Hanford nuclear reservation, I mean, that's a thing where you'll get every now and again, like once a year, there'll be a story, some jackass in a Cessna, you know, either his radio's gone out or he just doesn't know what he's doing, or it's one of the things where, you know, teach him a son to fly, and they'll be flying over the nuclear thing, and they'll get a whole lot of like, we will shoot you out of the sky and then stomp on your remains if you don't stop. Here's a creepy thing, actually. There's that. It's weird to think, actually, that there are places you can't fly in, like, the United States, because they'll just shoot you down.
Yeah.
They'll just kill you. If you are driving through, you know, the area, it's actually just sort of, it's just outside of my hometown, but if you're driving through there and you get toward the Hanford nuclear facility, you will actually get to a place where you will start to see a lot of fences and barbed wire, and you will see guys who are armed with what look very much like machine guns and signs saying, like, guards have authority to use deadly force. And then you just see a guy holding what looks like an Uzi and just sort of waving you back. And that's when you go, I think we've missed our exit somehow, honey. This isn't Des Moines or whatever. And so it's just a weird – there's places you don't want to screw with the government because they'll – especially now. I mean, in a post-9/11 era and whatnot, I think it's like a shoot first and second and ninth and 12th, and then ask questions maybe like someday eventually when they're subpoenaed, you know, and then they, you know, the you know, and everything's no longer under seal. Here's Dawn Taylor.
A Utah man had a 90-95% chance of dying after shattering his skull in more than 10 places until a neurosurgeon removed both sides of his head and froze it. Kyle Johnson's brain swelled uncontrollably after he fell off a longboard, essentially a surfboard on wheels, while traveling about 60 kilometers. How fast is that in miles per hour?
Like 40.
Yeah. Dr. Blake Welling of McKay D. Hospital in Utah decided to perform a risky surgery. We elected to take Kyle to surgery and remove each side of his head, Dr. Welling said.
What do you mean? Let's back up for a second. I can't tell if this is lingo or jargon or if it's just so simple that I don't understand it. What do you mean they removed each side of his head?
Well, Rick Emerson, it's called a bilateral decompressive craniectomy. It's something that neurosurgeons do as a last-ditch effort.
I would think so. I would think that's not like the first thing. I got a hangnail. Cut off his head!
They do a decompressive craniectomy on one side of the head where the trauma was, and that is common when there is a problem. Except in most cases, they only have to do it on one side of the head. In this case, Kyle had such a global brain injury that we needed to take both sides of his head off, and you just leave a small strip of bone right down the middle.
When you're saying, so he had basically a skull mohawk.
Yes. In a moment, I'll show you the picture.
I don't even know if I want to see that.
Dr. Welling and his team removed Mr. Johnson's fractured skull, put it back together with microscrews and plates, then put it in the freezer to prevent the bone from becoming brittle. Mr. Johnson was placed in a drug-induced coma for about 3 weeks while doctors monitor his brain swelling. After the swelling went down, Dr. Welling took the bone pieces out of the freezer, put them back into place, and it took Mr. Johnson about another week to wake up. I wasn't quite sure what we were going to be left with, Dr. Welling said. When people have injuries like this, I thought he might have a significant disability in terms of having to talk and walk again and learning his cognitive function, but lo and behold, Kyle woke up and his lights gradually went back on. That must be neurosurgeon lingo. His lights gradually went back on. Dr. Welling said, by all purposes, Mr. Johnson should have died. He had a very high mortality rate, he said. I told him, sometimes we're left with really terrible results, but in your case, you have a guardian angel and you have something to live for. He did not require any real physical therapy, although he's currently undergoing cognitive therapy to help with memory loss and things like multitasking. It's something that I do not have the ability to do right now, he said. If you put two color crayons in front of me, say blue and green, I really can't think of both crayons. I can only think of one at a time, okay, and that's a struggle.
But I don't even know if I want to see this photo. So they just took off the guy's skull.
It's it's not a gory photo because his
– Well, let me just see
his,
the
– You know, they didn't cut the skin off or anything.
Yeah,
he still has a face and everything. But
oh, that's just weird.
Yeah.
Because you don't really realize that without your skull there, your head isn't really the shape it normally is.
No.
It looks like his head looks like a sort of balloon that is deflating from the top down.
Yeah.
That's – I find that the whole thing about how you're carrying it like a big computer around inside your head, you know, just it's just very weird. And the whole thing about this, the skull itself is sort of great. I mean, I guess I'm glad it's there because you whack your head in a cupboard and suddenly you can't remember your mom's name or something. But it's just weird. It's just weird to think about it, that you actually – it's like so important that you actually have to have, you know, this like amazingly, you know, hard substance, you know, this like whole like cage around it basically to kind of keep it to keep it safe. But of course – I don't know if you do this. Do you ever just, when you see someone, a photo or read a story about someone who has some sort of an injury or a procedure-caused vulnerability, you then imagine in your head the worst-case scenario? Like this guy gets off the table and like bumps his head into like a cupboard.
Oh, God. I hadn't actually thought of that, but...
See, that's what I think of. Like they've removed his skull, and you pointed it out. It's not like they've removed the top of his head. Like they just opened his head, took out the skull, and then sewed the skin back up. So it's like he looks really, really normal if you can get away from the fact that inside his brain, his head is basically like one of those it's like one of those wacky wall walkers in terms of consistency, or like one of those squeezy balls they give you for like stress relief at the office or something. And so I'm just picturing if this guy goes, wait, hold on, somebody at the door, I'll get it. And he just, you know, sits up a little too, you know, and then right into a fluorescent light or something. That's a bad – you don't want to hear something terrible? You know what I did? Speaking of injuries to your head. So you want to talk about the worst pain. I don't know the worst pain you've ever experienced in your life. And we're just doing all the great talk show things today. I've already asked you your worst job. Here's the – I don't know the worst pain you've ever experienced, Don Taylor.
Wow.
Too late.
Yeah, I can't really tell you.
I can tell you the worst pain I ever experienced. And I don't know if it's a thing that many people can actually identify with because it's very specialized. Not a secret. I had the whole hair restoration thing.
Yeah, well, I heard you talking about that, and that sounds...
No, but that didn't hurt at all. That's the thing. The actual... I should be very clear by that. I'm not saying this is like... Not like they're giving me money to say this. The actual hair restoration thing, it felt like having like a, you know, like a moderate sunburn. Like, that didn't hurt at all. The actual... Even after the fact, when I got the, you know, the hair transplant and all that done, the operation didn't hurt at all. First of all, because they give you massive amounts of drugs. They give you Valium, then Vicodin, and then they just give you more of each, like over and over for like 16 hours.
I was just thinking because I've done the thing where I've had multiple hair treatments for things like bleached my hair and it didn't bleach quite enough, and so I washed it and then I bleached it again then colored my hair, and it's like. My and doing this thing where my scalp was actually twitching and hurting because I was damaging it so much.
No.
So I kept thinking about that when I was hearing about you and the.
I say this as a satisfied customer. The actual hair transplant doesn't hurt at all. Again, it feels like you kind of stayed out in the sun for an hour too long, you know, at the beach or something. You know, it kind of stings for a couple of days and then it's gone. Here's what did happen, and I only did this once, and this did hurt quite a lot. Because, you know, the deal is that they basically they say they transplant hair, but that's actually I was going to say fallacy, more of a fallacy. They don't transplant hair. They actually transplant the follicles. So what they do is they just take these tiny things, they're not quite microscopic, but they're like the, you know, pinpoint, and then they just kind of one by one they kind of go and they stick them into your scalp and, you know, whatever. So it's not like they're having to like operate on your scalp or anything as such, but you basically have like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of like pinholes, you know, in the top of your head or whatever. And so then they send you back home and they say, no, You want to be very careful. You don't want to, you know, because the top of your scalp is going to be very sensitive. You don't want to go screwing with that. And I did exactly what I was talking about this guy doing. I was like on the phone with somebody, and I'm like, all right, so what's the address? Where am I going for this shindig? Okay, hold on. Let me get a pen. Let me write that down. And I'm like leaning over the desk at home. I'm like, all right, 555, you know, Broadway Avenue. Okay, great. Thanks so much. Great. I'll see you there tonight. I put down the pen, put down the phone, and I lift my head up, and I was underneath a cupboard.
Oh, ah.
And here's the worst part about it is I wasn't even underneath just like the cupboard itself. I had actually, when the phone rang, I had been getting breakfast or something. So I was actually underneath the swung open door of a cupboard, and the corner of one of the cupboard doors went right into the top of my head after I'd had surgery on it.
Ah.
The surgery itself didn't hurt at all. A corner, a wooden corner into the top of your head at a high velocity, that hurts a lot.
Yeah. The first thing I thought of when you asked about that, kind of similarly, when I was working as a chef, I cut a chunk off the end of my thumb one night when we were getting ready for a dinner service, and I was chopping a bunch of apples, and I just chopped off like this the tip of my left thumb.
With what were you chopping? Just
a
knife?
A great big chef's knife.
Right, okay.
And it's one of those things that when it happens, you immediately look at it and you go, oh, that's bad.
That will hurt in a few seconds.
Yeah, and then it hurts, but it didn't hurt really that bad. And I tried to tape it up and I tried to bandage it, and it just kept bleeding and just kept bleeding. And people kept going, you need these stitches. And I'd never had stitches for anything before. And I was like, no, I don't need stitches. I'm fine. And it just kept bleeding out. And so finally my boss made me leave and told me I had to go to the emergency room and get stitches. So I called my ex-husband, because he was the closest person to the restaurant, to go with me. And he took me to the hospital in the emergency room. And I went in there. And the guy, the doctor comes in. He's like, okay, I'm going to have to numb this up. So I'm going to have to give you an injection. And he takes this needle full of like the anesthesia stuff, the numbing agent. And he jams the needle right into the wound the end of my thumb.
So you're put in your ankle? Where else is it supposed to go?
But he also warned me ahead of time. He goes, okay, so this is probably going to hurt a lot because you have a lot of nerve endings in your thumb, and this is like one of the most painful places we can do that. And it's just like, and it's like nothing had really hurt up until that point.
Yeah.
And my ex-husband told me that like down the hall through like two sets of closed double doors, he heard me like yell at the top of my lungs. Just this, you know, because it was horrifically painful.
Well, that's one of those things where maybe you don't, it almost doesn't hurt in some ways because you haven't really thought about it. You haven't processed it until you're there and you realize, okay, a doctor needs to numb me up because he's going to be sewing me shut with a needle and thread lest all of my blood pour out. I bet this, wah! And then it just suddenly, that's the, and plus, I mean, it's
but also
like,
it's like the thing with your having had the surgery and then bashing your head in the thing. It's like, it's almost like the original injury is only painful to a certain point, and then somebody jams something into it.
Yes.
That's way worse.
You know what's worse, Dawn?
What?
It's when you cut the tips off your fingers, and then you ruin a perfectly good rug on top of it. Or beneath it, as the case may be. Let's talk about the cleaning solution. If you have vast pools of blood filling your home and you need to have them removed, I would actually really call a lawyer first, actually. That'd be the first thing. I wouldn't say call Michael Bates. I'd say call a bondsman, and maybe somebody who has a series of false mustaches and passports. But then later, you might want to call Michael Bates, the cleaning solution, 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211, and I was mentioning this actually last hour. Sometimes it's not even this. Sometimes it's not like you're just doing everything you can to wreck the joint. Sometimes you move into a place. Well, this happened with our friends Dave and Sarah. Saw these guys this weekend, and you know they've been fixing part of the. Part of the house they've been sort of retiling, and they've been, they're putting things, in where they weren't. But some of the, rooms just need a good cleaning because you move in and you realize the guys were there before. You know, it's not like they were bad people or something. The carpets just get dirty. And especially if you move into a new place where the folks before you knew that they were going to be moving out. They knew they were going to be renting or selling or something. So they may not have taken the time to clean everything the way you want it cleaned. You start from scratch. That way you don't have, any of the odors or the smells or the dirt or stains or anything. You move into a place that is as close to new as you can possibly get it. And there's the same thing with an office. You're going to rent yourself an office space. You're going to be, some sort of, commercial area. You get that stuff taken down to where it is as clean and it is as new as you can possibly make it without actually the trouble of taking everything out, putting it back in again. So you contact Michael Bates. The Cleaning Solution is a locally owned and operated company. He's a longtime listener and a good guy to boot. 971-533-3211 is the contact number there. 971-533-3211. That's Mr. Michael Beatty and the cleaning solution. My name is Rick Emerson. We're going to do a little thing here. We'll be back after this. Coming up later in the program, we'll have Pop Culture Authority. That is coming up here in just a skosh. We'll be answering the question, why are porn films not prostitution? That's coming up later on. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week here as well. We may or may not get to a top five taser watch, religious nutcase watch, and all of that coming up. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here on the Emerson News Network. Stay there. We return momentarily. The Rick Emerson radio program, and hello to you. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Coming up in just a moment, we'll welcome Ms. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week to the program. Coming up after that, we will talk to Don Taylor about stories including the following on this Wednesday.
Sarah Palin is going to get her own reality show. A policeman needs a SWAT team after he's trapped in a patrol car. And a man tases police with their own taser.
Fantastic. Also, Religious Nutcase Watch on the way. We may or may not get to this sort of a Super Darwin Watch. And there's a whole bunch of other things. So things are just stacking up faster than we can. The entertainment and amusements are fast, stacking up faster than we can dispatch them to you, the good people of Portland. So we are up.
We have more merriment than we can actually pack into one show.
Really, it is 500 pounds of diversionary fantasticality put into, I would say, a 9-ounce container.
Exactly.
And so forth. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show from Willamette Week, arts and culture editor Kelly Clark. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great. Nice to be here.
We have to get you like an introductory theme. I think we talked about this last time and it was just a busy show. We didn't really get a chance to talk about it. Did you have a theme at the KUFO show, but I was always like half asleep, and I think most of us were high, so, you know.
Yeah, the whole entire time.
Yeah.
Ecstasy. Peyote.
I can't even really remember what it was, because we had the food porn theme.
No, the food porn theme changed a couple times. I think most of the time it was Barry White, but the Kelly Clark theme, if there was one, was Minnesota from Dandy Warhol.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so I will...
Which I still quite like that one.
We can use that. No, that can be taken care of. All right. So we got a couple things we're talk about today in terms of Willamette Week. One is this, and we'll get to all of this here in a second, and then, you know, even then we'll hold a little something back because you got to make the people pay for it. You know, there's nothing.
Absolutely.
You know, you can't just be giving everything away.
Isn't that paper free?
Well, yeah, but
some people don't like to read.
Oh. Words are hard, Dawn.
They're difficult.
I'm just saying.
I'm saying they're not making them pay for it, though, because even if they do, and I'm not saying they should not go pick up the
They're paying with effort, Dawn.
Otherwise, this week's newspaper is studded with spikes, so sometimes it's just difficult to get around that.
I'm just saying we would like for them to see it in its natural environment, because otherwise it's like we're chewing their food for them and then lovingly shoving that food into their ears with the tips of our pointy tongues. That's the worst thing I've ever said. I have never, ever, no phrase that horrific has ever left my mouth before.
Something happens to you when Kelly Clark walks into the room. You change.
You change into a mama bird, apparently.
Start talking about my tongue all the time.
Yeah.
His tongue.
Anyway, so
once he touched my arm inappropriately as well.
I heard that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. So we'll talk about kombucha, which is this. And I keep saying it's like a tea made out of mold because I'm almost certain that's what it is, but I could be wrong.
It's actually made out of a symbiote. Let's see if I can remember this. Symbiotic colony of bacteria. I'm missing one of the words because it's like SCOBY is the...
That sounds a lot tastier.
The word you're missing is mold. That's what mold is, I think.
Yeah, nasty Flemish stuff. It basically looks like every piece of phlegm and fat and nastiness all in the world dunked into a vat of tea and then fermented. And then people drink it.
And if anybody thinks that we're sort of exaggerating this, I would encourage you to go online and to read the article or see this. Here's what it looks like.
Don't the kombucha enthusiasts, then they call that like the mushroom?
Yes, they call it the mother. They call it the mushroom. But it's not a mushroom. It is it's a creepy bacteria thing. I mean, okay, you know, when you ferment anything, you're involving creepy bacteria. But this thing really looks like it. It looks like the blob.
It's awful.
It's nasty.
Yeah, I should actually just skip to the bottom of the page and just take a picture of, you know, the large jars of this that are sitting like in every nook and cranny and crevice and opening in my home, because, you know, my wife's that thing where she's sort
been
of
infected,
like, well, she's sort of like a hippie on the inside, you know. What I mean,
see.
It's like and I wasn't really told about that in advance. Like, I think that's a sort of where you move into the house, like, they don't tell you, and then the caretaker went crazy on a night just like this 50 years ago, and then you try to sleep and then the paintings are crying blood. That's what it's like in my home, except it's kombucha. So we'll get to all of that here in just a few, plus Pop Culture Authority coming up later on, Taser Watch, and all that at the news desk. This is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Sarah Palin's popularity is about to be put to the test. Plans are in the works for a reality show, Sarah Palin's Alaska.
Hurrah!
That will debut on TLC just days after the midterm elections in November. Huffington Post founding editor Roy Seacoff explains why it seems Americans can't get enough of the former vice presidential candidate and her family.
I think that they are a soap opera come to life. I mean, the stuff that happens to this family, you couldn't put these together if you were a writer for All My Children.
He sounds way too enthused about the entire thing.
He sounds like one of those TMZ guys.
I was just going to say, he sounds like one of those guys who ought to be standing on a beach with Harvey Levin, just sort of going, and, you know, the thing about her is that she is a drama queen like we have never seen before.
And I saw her coming out of Starbucks and she was wearing sweatpants.
Gibbering himself into a frenzy about it. So what is it? But it's called Sarah Palin's Alaska?
That's a boring name.
I mean, that's
just
a terrible
name. Just be like getting
name.
Wild with Sarah or something, at least.
That's, I mean, you got to wonder if that's a thing. To what... I know that reality shows, you know, they're all, you know, edited to create, you know, the sort of false illusion of whatever. But this goes beyond that. Like, I wonder to what extent she's even involved in it. If it's just a sort of thing that, like, one of her people. I wonder if she actually even has people, though, because there was that numbskull husband of hers, Todd. And it was
the snowmobile salesman.
And it just, you know, he just, you know what he looked like? He always looked like. He looked like one of the one of. Isn't there a third Wilson brother? There's Luke Wilson and Owen Wilson. Who's the third?
Yeah,
Wilson
the one
brother?
In Bottle Rocket.
That
yes.
And he's also in in Rushmore, and he's like the track coach, and he has this sort of James Hetfield mustache.
Yeah, that
and
dude.
No permits of any kind were obtained for this piranha tank. I don't know why he thought he could do it. That's what Todd Palin looks like. And you always heard that he was sort of the guy behind the curtain, that he was the one who was pulling the strings on, you know, all of Sarah Palin's sort of political machinations and so forth. But I get the feeling he's been sort of moved to the sidelines in her particular operation because she's, because she wants to win something this time. So anyway, so that launches when? When is the actual air date for that?
I was just looking online trying to find somebody that would actually explain what it is, and no one will say.
Well.
No, it just says it'll debut after the midterm elections in November. So
I would imagine it's going to be fairly
so
toothless.
So she can hang out with trappers. And,
I mean,
is she going to go try out kooky new jobs? I mean, basically, is it going to be dirty jobs with Sarah Palin?
That is probably not too far from the truth, because the thing is, even though she's no longer the governor, she still has that thing of wanting to talk about, you know, the common people, mm-hmm. and wanting to talk about, you know, what average Americans are going through in these here financial times. And so I will guarantee you that it'll be like some weird on the road with Charles Carralt thing, but it'll be her going and, you know, and just going to some guy's house where he's going to make like grilled woodchuck or something like
that.
Well,
I eat seal blubber. It's true.
Apparently also one episode will feature footage of the fishing trip that the Palins and Kate Gosselin took with her kids.
All right. So.
There's two birds with one stone.
Worlds collide.
Canoe.
Yeah. Good God almighty. All right, here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
Let's do our Taser Watch.
All right, here is your Taser Watch for, what is this, is it Wednesday? Here is your Taser Watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson Radio program. Don Taylor with your Taser Watch.
A Missouri man is facing several criminal charges after police said he fled from a burning stolen car and 3 hours later assaulted a police officer with his own taser. Police said that Anthony Thornton, 24, ran from the stolen car, a 2001 Dodge Intrepid, about 1 p.m. Saturday after the vehicle caught fire along eastbound Highway 40 near Interstate 270. A police officer spotted Thornton a short distance away, but before he could be handcuffed, he ran across a highway to Missouri Baptist Medical Center. He later ran from the hospital in stolen medical scrubs and got on a bus. Police stopped the bus around 3:15 p.m., but Thornton then escaped into the woods. Shortly after 4 p.m., another officer spotted Thornton walking north alongside Interstate 270. When the officer tried to arrest Thornton, he resisted and twice tried to grab the officer's weapon.
This is like seven or eight separate great stories that have all been chained together into one sort of unholy Mary Shelley's The Best Story Ever.
Sounds like The Fugitive 3.
The other thing, when you just read the first, I know we haven't actually finished it, but just read the opening line again, just the first sentence.
A Missouri man is facing several criminal charges after police said he fled from a burning stolen car and 3 hours later assaulted a police officer with his own taser.
You know, here's what that sounds like to me. You know what that is? That's like when you were watching some gripping action-oriented program and it starts with the thing that actually happens about 50 minutes into the show. It starts with the climactic incident and then it jumps back in time and you go, how did this happen? You know, and then it goes back to that morning when he's like, I've got a great idea.
Yeah, he stole a car. Somehow the vehicle caught fire. He ran away from the burning car. Cops stopped him, but he ran into a hospital, then left in stolen scrubs, jumped on a bus. The police stopped the bus, then he ran into the woods. He was spotted walking down the road about 45 minutes later. The cop tried to arrest him. He resisted and got the officer's taser and shot it at the officer's left arm, causing second-degree burns and grazing the officer's forehead. Two passing motorists, who happened to be in law enforcement, came to the officer's aid and helped subdue Thornton.
This may, in fact, be the best taser watch that we've ever had because it's got every single element. It's got pursuit, it's got scrubs, it's got a bus, it's got fire, it's got stealing, it's got multiple tasings, it's got other cops just inadvertently sort of stopping by and saying, hey, it looks like you need some help. And then presumably this guy just being pounded into a fine paste by some of the law enforcement officials.
He was on probation for unrelated charges and fought officers out of fear of returning to prison.
I instinctively disbelieve that the charges were unrelated, by the way. It seems like everything in this story is related
to
this guy's...
it was a different burning stolen car. And
that's the frustrating thing, because they don't explain how it is that... How did the car just come to be in flames?
Spontaneous combustion.
I mean, would you rule that out at this point? I mean, it really seems to be a story
with... Maybe he's a fire starter. Maybe we're not looking deep enough into this story.
Some sort of pyrotelekinesis to which we were not
privy. That's probably the most logical... That's how the second degree burns is probably from that.
His fear of being caught caused the engine to overheat to such a degree that it burst into flames.
Absolutely.
Because he did it with his mind.
It really is like it's sort of a kitchen sink taser story. Awesome. Fantastic. That's the one by which all other taser watches will be judged in the future. There's your taser watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson radio program. You got me running, going out of my mind. I can do it! Let's do one more here, and then we will talk a bit more about what's in the Willamette this week.
A North Carolina policeman was forced to hide out in his patrol car for 3 hours after he was surrounded by 50,000 angry bees. The insects had escaped from a crashed truck on a highway yesterday morning. When Sheriff's Deputy Brandon Jenkins was called to the scene, he was horrified to find that its cargo had been 60 boxes of honeybees. He showed up just after the sun had risen and roused the sleeping insects from their night's nest. They promptly swarmed his car, forcing him to leap inside and radio for help.
Bees!
Where is Google Earth when you need it, really? I mean, where is the Google Street Cam, thing, just to, like, to capture every glorious moment of this?
Tens of thousands of bees covered the vehicle as he waited for beekeeping experts to be tracked down by the police. The beekeepers eventually managed to calm the bees down using smoke, but not before Jenkins had to kill a few that found their way into the car. It was more or less self-defense, he said. There were a couple of bees in my personal space, my comfort zone, and I just wanted to get them out.
There's so many things about this story that
there's a photo of a car with bees all
over. Oh, that's actually terrifying.
See, and the thing is,
I actually feel bad for the cop.
I'm not afraid of bees or anything because they typically, it's not like they screw with you most of the time, but 60,000 of anything is terrifying. It doesn't matter how cute and doesn't matter how many Hallmark cards you put them on. They're unnerving. Okay, let's just go through these one by one. First of all, this is like the fifth story we've had in about 6 months of a truck tipping over that's full of bees. You would think at some point, not unlike oil tankers, they would maybe re-examine the bee wrangling techniques that they are using.
Or the training for people who are driving trucks full of bees.
When is the last time that a truck just filled with, harmless fun tipped over somewhere? A truck filled with daisies and rainbows. It's always something like bees or marbles or just something that's going to cause all manner of difficulty. 50,000 angry bees. So he gets called. So I guess it tipped over in the early morning or something, and then it tipped over. But it tipped over early enough that they were asleep and sort of still slow. Yeah. And then he arrived just as there's sort of a collective like sort of
a giant chainsaw of bees.
What I would give to just to have been, you'll forgive me, a fly on the wall there as he's. I mean, I wonder what the look on his face was as he said,
"Well, what's all this in?" He wanders over to the box and then yells, "Bees!" and has to run back to his car.
What's that humming noise? And then just the image of 60,000 bees sort of en masse, just sort of going like that way, whoosh, and then going at the guy, and then he's in his car, which then leads us to this great phrase. He had to kill a few bees. Would found their way into his car, which sort of implies that they're sending, they're sort of like scouts, they go and they're like Luke, where they're looking for the exposed exhaust port, trying to navigate their way inside so they can tell the others. Jesus. All right. Well, there you go.
I do have a question from the text box.
Yes.
Someone asks, I apologize for this ahead of time. Again, not my question, a question from the text box. I read this verbatim. Is Kelly Clark hotter than balls? She sounds like it. Yes, sir. Yes, she is hotter than balls.
Thank you. I'm glad you were.
I think I should get that tattooed somewhere.
You know, hot as balls is a phrase that really had faded into disuse on this program. I'm glad. I'm not saying I've forgotten about it as such. It was just one of those. It's one of those phrases that it's like an old Windows file. You know, that you like a JPEG that you found amusing that you downloaded like 3 years ago that you kind of forgot about.
It doesn't really make sense though, because isn't the point of testicles being on the outside of the body that they will be at a lower body temperature than the rest of you?
Here's where that phrase came from. I'll tell you exactly where it came from. Like many things on this program, it is more or less a direct lift from the Don and Mike show. Because one of the real – and I know that that show still exists. Don has retired, although I guess he's doing his own show in not KTLA. It's something – KTRK, I think, in Sacramento for folks who want to be able to listen to him online. But Mike O'Mara and those guys are doing their own online thing without Don. But one of the great the things about the Don and Mike show, they had a true gift for – they had the gift of absurdity, where they would string together words that didn't really mean anything, and that didn't even have like a figurative meaning, but that just sounded fantastic. And one of those things was they would just frequently describe something and say, "That is hot as balls," which doesn't mean anything at all. It as you just said, it doesn't make any kind of sense. But there's just something sort of gloriously ridiculous about it. And so we latched onto that immediately.
Can you, either of you, explain to me the phrase "balls to the wall"? Where does that come from, and why?
That's a good question, Kelly Clark.
Balls to the wall.
You're a journalist.
I'd say it's a reference to Breakfast Club with the elephantitis of the nuts being so large that they practically don't fit into a room.
No, it's almost certainly not that. Thank you.
Like Rick knows.
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Rick's really going to challenge me on that?
Because it literally doesn't make sense
in
the context that it is used.
I don't know. I have no explanation for that.
Because nobody, when they're really trying hard at something, presses their balls to a wall.
No, so
not like keeping your nose to the grindstone in any way.
I'm going to keep my shoulder to the wheel and my balls to the wall.
And we're going to
do the best
show
we can do. I don't think you could affect any situation positively by doing this.
Well, here's what we should do. I've already come to the conclusion that this will be tomorrow's Pop Culture Authority.
Okay,
so tomorrow's Pop Culture Authority, we will explain the derivation of the phrase balls to the walls. We'll get to that tomorrow.
Thank you.
All right. Well, in any event, did we do the one more? It was the bee story, was it?
Yeah.
All right.
Bees.
Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. So let's get back to this kombucha thing. So that is, first of all, that's in the issue that is out today?
It's in today's issue. It's all about nasty, fetid, illegal kombucha.
So just to back up so we have some sort of foundation for this. Kombucha is, to the best of my knowledge, it is a sort of a fermented tea-like beverage that people make, and my wife included. And the only way I can explain what it looks like is, when I was a kid, my mom, who's a simple woman, she would whenever she would make like the bacon or anything like that, she would of course then just save all the bacon grease because then you use it later for whatever, and she would pour it into like a coffee can, which then went into the fridge because we
still do that.
Sophisticates. And it is as though you sliced off the top 3 or 4 inches of that coagulated bacon fat and floated it on top of a jar of iced tea. That's what it looks like.
It always makes me think of coffee, like if you forget that you had like about a third of a cup of coffee somewhere in a cup, and then you find it like a week later and you go, "Oh, what's this? Oh!" And there's that layer of mold floating on top of the fetid coffee, and you try to pour it down and it just kind of goes thunk.
Like a giant loogie hocked up by some sort of animal monster, like pig man monster.
Well, the other thing that they do, I guess, a pig man monster coming this October on Sci-Fi. The other thing that they do, because they're hippies and so therefore filthy, horrid people, is that if you are going to begin drinking the kombucha yourself for whatever reason, I guess the deal is that it's like part of the whole ritual that you don't make it yourself. It's like that you'll go somebody else will cut off a wedge of their scum and give it to you, and then you use that as like a seedling to make your own jars of scum. This is what I've been told. I've just gleaned this from accidental conversations that I have overheard my wife having.
And we haven't even talked about what it tastes like yet.
I have no idea. And, you know, here's the thing. I'm never going to find out. Have you had it?
Fuzzy vinegar scum. We actually did a whole taste test for this because the thing about this is that kombucha, I mean, it's been getting bigger and bigger the last couple of years. And now there's whole companies. I mean, there's a Coca-Cola subsidiary that makes kombucha. So it's big business. And what this story is actually about is the idea that they found out that once you stick scum into tea and ferment it and then stick it in bottles and put it on a shelf, it keeps fermenting. And it turns into alcohol.
So eventually then you have
So you have boozy, fetid, vinegary scum water.
At least it's useful then.
Yeah, but the government, the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade, found this out and was like, nope, sorry, it's illegal. And then they enacted a voluntary recall. So all the bigwig companies like GT's and Natural and Hanes and like basically anything you could get at Whole Foods, mm-hmm. they pulled all of their kombucha off the shelves in mid-June.
Well, no, wait a minute. Was it only certain kinds that were turning into alcohol, or was it just
anything that any of the kombucha that isn't pasteurized?
Okay.
It turns into booze if you leave it on the shelf long enough. So all
so
of the
it's friendship scum beer.
It's scum beer, basically, which it makes it sound better to me, obviously, as well. But so like Whole Foods like pulled all of it off the shelves, and so in the last month, anybody local who makes kombucha, who's little, they have just been inundated with calls. People want to get their stuff. It doesn't matter. They got to have their kombucha fix, and they have to get it from all the small local companies because all the big national companies, their stuff doesn't exist anymore.
And presumably people pay for this.
Oh, yes.
Rick Emerson likes what he's hearing. He is connecting the dots in his head as we speak. So that makes me wonder then where all my wife's... I want to say
wife could make bucks off her nasty scum juice.
I was just going to say, I would say her dirtbag friends, but it's not even really that because my wife, not unlike many people, I think my wife has different circles of friends. Mm-hmm. So she has like her work friends who are all like, you know, they're really sort of Tony and, you know, and educated and whatever. And then, you know, and then she's got all of her friends who are always like dragging her to like a country fair in Eugene. You know, do you want to go sleep on some dirt and go to a place, you know, where they just sell clay pipes and stink? And she'll say, yes. And then she'll go. Those guys, though, they would probably pay out the ass for this. So and I've got liquid gold sitting at home.
You do, man. All you have to do is take it down to Alberta Co-op and start selling it. In fact, Oregon Kombucha is a company that's just a lady and her mom who started making it a year ago because, you know, they had a bunch of friends and they'd been making it. So they started making DIY kombucha kits. Well, as soon as this hit, they couldn't keep them in stock. People were going to Alberta Co-op and buying them off the shelves. They're like, do you have some kombucha? Where can I get your kombucha? I need my kombucha now.
Now, is it just like an Oregon thing? I mean, do they sell in the rest of the country?
They sell in the rest of the country. In fact, what's really funny is Oregon has the only pasteurized kombucha as well. The guy from Stash Tea, one of the Steves, there's like Steve Lee and Steve Jones or something. There's two guys who own Stash Tea. They make the only pasteurized kombucha on the market, which is Kombucha Wonder Drink. So when everything else got pulled off the shelf, they were the only man left standing. But they're pasteurized, which means all the hippies don't like to drink it because it's not raw and it's not natural and it doesn't still have the scum bucket in the bottom of the bottle, like the loogie ball in the bottom of the bottle.
So what is the nasty scum juice supposed to do for you anyway?
Supposedly it's like a major health tonic. It can, you know, it helps with indigestion. Like, well, Ruth, the writer, I mean, people told her it cured cancer, that it helped with baldness. Like, basically, if something ails you, apparently kombucha by drinking this fetid thing... Can you tell I don't like the taste of it? Yeah.
I mean, well, let's just do this. I have so many questions about this. We'll try to organize this into some sort of, first of all, just to back up for a second, we keep referring to it as like tea with scum in it. Maybe you said this and I missed it somehow, but what is the, like if I have iced tea, that is essentially like just a black tea leaf that they have dried and crumbled mm-hmm. and that you run water through. What is this actually made of?
It is tea. It's tea plus the symbiotic colony of bacterial organisms.
But where did that come
from? Oh, that was the whole
scoby
thing.
Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's like, where did that originally...
The original
actual,
scoby
the scum,
come
like,
from?
What is that,
I think they were digging in a tunnel somewhere, and they found, like, a big white grub worm, and they got hacked off a piece of it, and that's what happened.
It's from that cave in the hot zone where Ebola came from.
Pretty much.
Oh, God. Oh, so aliens
take us over, by the way, is through the kombucha. That's how it's happened.
And I love how it's, like, so black market. I mean, Ruth, who's our writer, she's Australian, and so she just got to America like a month or two ago.
It's her first taste
and so
of
she's like, I want to try, you know, I can't even do her accent, but she's like, I want to try kombucha. And like, she's like, I heard it's illegal now, so I have to go find it. And so she starts searching around online. She ends up biking to outer southeast Portland on like a 95 degree heat, you know, day to like this Eastern European woman's house and like knocks on the door and she's like, do you want to taste it? Do you want it? And
wow.
then like Ruth's like, yeah, I guess. Like this. And she's, do you want it now? Like this. And they go into her kitchen and just like, she's like, do you want it with
I'm
the scoby?
I'm just picturing like the metal sliding thing open in the door and just the eyes appear and they get, oh, you know, and you have to say like, Red Rover lands on Mars. The fat man walks alone. And then he opens the door.
My favorite part, she describes a woman, a young woman of Eastern European appearance answers the door with big hair and small jeans.
But it's now. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. As I'm talking about this, in over there, is it actually illegal though to be just like making your own?
No, not at all.
Even if it goes into booze, as long as you're not like selling that, or
as long as you're not selling it. And it was a voluntary recall because right now, like, it's anything over. I think it's in the story. It's like 0.05 or something percent is legally alcohol.
Okay,
but it's not to the point like. No, the kombucha makers are not trying to get anybody drunk. It's just technically over
right,
the line.
Right.
So that was why it was a voluntary recall. Well, all of the big companies, they don't wait. You know,
sure.
They're just like, uh-uh. So they pulled everything. So you can do kombucha Wonder Drink, which is pasteurized, or all the little people like Oregon Kombucha and all those people who are small businesses that they're not going to care unless somebody starts actually instill they do like a full recall. And then the guy who owns Townsend Tea here in Portland as well actually spent a buttload of money to work with scientists to find out a way to stop the second fermentation. So he's back on the shelves as well.
So what does it taste like in its natural state when it hasn't – when it hasn't gone bad. But I mean it's all bad. But before it turns into alcohol, when you're drinking it the way it's supposed to be, what does it taste like?
It tastes a little bit like fizzy vinegar tea.
See?
With like – it's with just like this gaggy aftertaste. And you know me. I mean, I'm over – I come in here all the time and I eat weird stuff and I like weird stuff. It's vinegary.
I almost feel like I am now obligated – as a zany radio host, to bring in some of my wife's goddamn kombucha from home tomorrow and just drink it. Just because how can I not? I mean, it's, you know, I mean.
As a child, I had all of these tests for things that I was allergic to. And one of the things I was allergic to was mold. And honestly, every time I hear about kombucha, in my mind, I have this feeling that, like, all I would do, I would take a sip of it and then I just suddenly have an asthma attack.
Yeah, but man,
it just seems bad for
people
you.
People are freaks for it. Like, there's a couple women at my work who just like, kombucha, where?
Yeah.
Give it to me. I got to have it.
My
it's
wife,
crazy.
She ran out at one point because she went on vacation. She was traveling somewhere. I forget where she was going, maybe. She was gone, and it was something where, like, she was drinking, like, the last before she left, and she meant to make some so it would be ready when she got back, and she, you know, got behind, didn't do it. Anyway, so she comes back from being gone, and she walks in the front door. She's like, oh, I'm so glad to be back home. And it was like, it was like Requiem for a Dream or something, where I'm like, baby, it's so good to see you. And she walks right by me and, like, goes into the kitchen and goes to the cupboard, and she opens it. It's like, goes right for the cupboard, and it was empty because she'd forgotten to make it. And it was, the camera does the long pull back as she's, you know, no! And she realized she was out. And she actually, the first thing she did was to get on the phone and call a friend of hers to ask if she's, hey, you got any kombucha?
Called her dealer.
Yeah. And she just had to go over and like get a jar of it or whatever. So, and which that almost made me want to try it because I thought, well, anything that's addictive has to be good. So, I guess I'll bring some in tomorrow.
Why is it addictive? Is it purely psychological or is it something that's, you know?
It must be. I mean, it's...
It does. Know. I mean, most people say it gives you a nice lift and it settles your stomach a lot of the time. It helps with digestion and that kind of stuff. But
I mean, it's not like it's bad for him. And I suppose tea...
It's just a phlegm tea, man.
In general.
I just don't...
Well, and if it's regular tea that is...
Vinegary
phlegm tea. If it's regular tea that has had this sort of mold thing added to it, and I'm with you in that it, to me, you know, the whole thing of mold, it's like drinking a glass of ragweed. But, you know, if it's tea, then presumably, I mean, depending on what you're using, it presumably would it better have caffeine in it, maybe. And if it has caffeine and even a minuscule amount of alcohol, if you ingest enough of that over a regular amount of time, your body will develop some sort of craving for it. So it seems like part of that is just the simple chemical process of introducing any kind of addictive chemical into your body. But that being said, again, it's like I feel like I got to get myself. And do you chill it or do you drink it like – because hers is always just like – I think it's like right out of the cupboard.
Yeah, they like to keep it because they keep it on the shelves because if you refrigerate it, then it would actually kill the fermentation and then you wouldn't even have the booze problem. So they usually serve it room temperature. And we actually did a taste test at work at a bunch of Oregon ones. We did 5 Oregon kombuchas, and then we did the one that Ruth, our writer, made herself with the alien blob she got from the Eastern European woman with the big hair and small jeans. And she called it Ruth's Butch Hooch. And she actually just put it in like a 2-liter Coke bottle. And, you know, we tried all the other ones, and like one was like lemon lime ginger flavor and one with strawberry flavor.
God damn.
To be honest, we all like Ruth's homemade stuff way better, mostly because it had only been sitting there for like 2 days, so it really didn't taste like kombucha.
I gotta create something that hippies will buy. That's where the money is. The money is in 3 things: selling stuff to people who have kids, people who have dogs, people who, anything where you put the word homeo in front of it and they go, I gotta, or if I can say, no, native peoples embraced this as a method, and they go, sold. Like, if you can tell them a brown person somewhere like 500 years ago loved it, they are all over it.
How do you think neti pots got popular?
Well, that's the whole thing. Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, see, also.
I will say, though, those actually
I actually was thinking about that as one of those things that I actually have and I have used on occasion.
I held off on that for a while because, you know, the neti pots are sold with the whole, you know. And the Buddhist monks do
the
this
crystals,
to rinse out their
crystals in the
faces,
background.
And the Indian shaman show you how to. And it's like, come on, no, really, it's just.
But
you know,
seriously, it's just really satisfying to shove a pot up your nose and just have water stream out
See,
of it.
And I instinctively believed the neti pot thing. You know why? Because that's the same method I use to like hose out my shrubs at home.
Yeah.
You know, I get water, I spray the water at the thing that I want gone, and eventually the dirt, it's gone with the water hose. It's not like you're sticking a candle in your ear or something.
No.
I mean, it's not like some unhinged hippie lunacy.
Now, how about this? How about kombucha for dogs?
Or lil kombucha. You know,
baby
the smallest, like a carbonated sort of fizzy.
Fizzy baby bucha.
That's what I'm talking. Do you see that thing where they're making they're making carbonated milk now for kids because they think that's going to get kids to drink, which it won't, by the way.
That's the most disgusting idea.
To get them to drink milk in school. The other thing, and I don't even know how this works, but I desperately want to try one. There's this company in England, and their whole specialty is carbonating things that ought not be carbonated because of the theory that then the small folk, that young kids will consume whatever, you know, healthy food if you make it fizz.
Kids these days.
I swear to God. I read this story in the Examiner. It was like in a real newspaper where it said that in addition to the aforementioned carbonated milk, they were, I swear to Christ, making a carbonated apple. Not apple juice. An actual carbonated apple. So it was like a sort of Alka-Seltzer-y, sort of like you bite into the apple and it was like a Pop Rocks apple or something. But I really want to try one. That
actually kind of sounds good.
It kind of sounds cool.
It's better than like carbonated meat or something. I mean,
carbonated meat. Do you watch Better Off Ted?
Yeah, I've watched it a couple times.
Better Off Ted is this show that Cheryl kind of co-turned me onto. And it's the whole thing is they work at this sort of company, this research and development company that just makes bizarre things. And at one point they were making a sort of like, it was the story we had like yesterday, the making meat in a laboratory, sure. Except that there was this accident where the meat tasted like sadness. real quickly, before we do anything else, I have one more thing I'm going to ask you about. Then we will take a break. We'll do Pop Culture Authority here in just a moment. And we'll come back on the other side. We'll talk a bit more about the happenings in the world. We'll try to squeeze into top five if we have time. So you got the kombucha thing. That is the new Willamette Week, which is on stands right now. And you can read it as well at wweek.com. Lady Gaga, that's tomorrow, right?
That is tomorrow. I'm going.
Really?
Oh, yes.
I'm jealous. I really am legitimately, honestly jealous. That's fantastic. Because I'm sure it sold out just forever ago. I'm sure there's no way that I, a humble serf, could go.
You know, I don't think it's sold out yet.
Really?
If you want to shell out the ducats for it, I think it's like 50,
I'm tempted
50
to go.
To 100 bucks.
Here's why I'm tempted to go. A, because I'm not going to try to pretend to be cooler than I am, because I dig some of her music. And also, that Alejandro song, which... It's like
Alejandro.
Every time it's out of my head, a car will drive by on the street, I think for the sole purpose of putting it back in my head. And then it just sits there forever. Also, I mean, she's a legitimate pop culture phenomenon. And that's the sort of thing that really intrigues me. The same reason I would see the Spice Girls 10 years ago, because they were like a huge thing. And I wanted to see what the deal is.
I just want to see what she's going to wear. I want to see what the entire pageantry of it is. I mean, that's just...
We were talking to Ryan White about this, actually, on Monday. And the reason that I dig her so much is because... I'm not going to say that I dig Lady Gaga because she irritates people. That's not it. But it's that the people who are irritated by her, you can judge an artist, in my opinion, by the people who love them and the people who hate them. And exactly the right kind of people hate Lady Gaga. And those are guys who sit around and they talk about Steve Vai and whether he's a better guitar player than Joe Satriani, because that's being a real musician. And, you know, they're always graying, a lot of thin on top, still kind of a shaggy ponytail on the back. And they listen to a lot of Frank Zappa. And they hate Lady Gaga, so she must be great. I mean, that's how I've deduced it. It's, you know, that guy hates her, so I have to listen. And I listened, and sure enough, I loved it. And I love the fact that she is completely and totally artificial. And I don't mean that she's not, and I don't mean in the sense that she's not talented, because she is. If you've seen any of like her early sort of performances where it's just her and a piano and a microphone, I'm not saying she's the most talented person ever, but I mean, she's got a fair amount of musical talent and some, I believe, some classical training. But that almost doesn't even matter. It's that her persona is entirely and absolutely a construct from scratch, which is great. I mean, that is a sort of a hallmark of entertainment. And she does it really well.
No, I think that's the best part about her. I really could care less. I don't think her songs are that great, but I don't think Madonna's songs are that great either. I mean, it is the pageantry of it. It's a show. Costuming every single angle of her life. And I can't imagine that it's not going to be a great show. I never got to see the Madonna Blonde Ambition Tour, but I'm going to go see Lady Gaga go insane in Portland.
You know, the people will talk about something being just sort of entertaining. Well, it's sure. It's entertaining. But
what else is there?
And to me,
it's the same reason I love True Blood. Seriously.
That's what I'm saying. To me, it's like entertainment. It sounds like such a broad statement to say entertainment gets a bad rap. But they will call something just entertaining or escapism as though that, and they'll say it as sort of a, you know, it's a backhanded, is it a backhanded insult or backhanded compliment?
Backhanded compliment.
It's a thing. It's a backhanded compliment. You know, we're really, really trying to knock it. And I mean, it's an art. It is a really valuable, crucial part of human existence. And I'm not trying to be overly thinky about it. I mean, that is a thing that we require, I think, to live. And she does it really well. And the thing is, she doesn't do it half-assed. She risks looking silly or stupid or embarrassing. And she risks people making fun of her. She doesn't, because she goes like balls to the wall with it, one might say. Yeah!
Very good.
That's what I'm talking about. All right. We'll come back here in just a few. We got more news on the way. We may or may not have time for a top five. That is all coming up. And we'll take a break here, and we will have Dawn Taylor with Pop Culture Authority. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program right here on the Emerson News Network.
Why is pornography not prostitution?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Dawn Taylor. We all know, or think we know, what defines prostitution: the exchange of money for sexual services. So why isn't it just as illegal for a producer to pay people to have sex on camera as it is for you to pay a Craigslist hooker to pay playhouse in your hotel room? In both cases, somebody's paid for sex, right? The answer, as the law sees it, is intent. Adult film performers are not defined as prostitutes. In a landmark court case, People v. Freeman, Harold Freeman hired and paid actors to perform in an erotic film called Caught from Behind Part 2. As part of their roles, the performers engaged in various sexually explicit acts. The state of California charged him and convicted him with 5 counts of pandering, defined as procurement of persons for the purpose of prostitution, under the California Penal Code. But the California Supreme Court noted that in order for there to be pandering, there must be prostitution. And the court noted that for an act to constitute prostitution, quote, the genitals, buttocks, or female breast of either the prostitute or the customer must come in contact with some part of the body of the other for the purpose of sexual arousal or gratification of the customer or of the prostitute. Since the payment of the acting fees was the only payment, there was no evidence that any payment was made for the purpose of sexual gratification. The law views sex as significant because of the intent of the act as well as the result. If it occurs without consent, it's rape. If it takes place between a married person and a third party, it's adultery. If it occurs and leads to the birth of a child, then the man is legally responsible for that child until the age of 18. And if it happens in exchange for a fee, it's prostitution. Pretending to have sex, though, for a camera or in private, triggers none of these legal consequences and can therefore be characterized as mere acting. There you go. While it seems like a moral conundrum, it really just comes down to a matter of whether or not the sex involves acting. The next time you invite a lady of the night to visit you for 45 minutes of no-strings horseplay, just have her sign a release form first, take her resume, and have her read Cordelia's death scene from King Lear. It may not cover you legally, but it's worth a shot.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us today. It's 503-505-6964. You are now a little bit smarter than you were just moments ago. 503-505-6964. On tomorrow's program, that would be Thursday, we will answer the question, what is up with the phrase balls to the wall? As that's coming up tomorrow. Also, Mr. Peter Carlin from the Oregonian will join us tomorrow. Friday, Brett Burmeister, who is a Portland blogger discussing food carts, will be here. That is Friday. We are joined today by Ms. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. And so forth. All right, still on the way if we have time. We may or may not get to the top five today. We will endeavor to do so. Without further ado, at the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Pranksters ended fun for many families after they decapitated a large dinosaur statue outside of a business in Norman, Oklahoma. The big green fiberglass dinosaur sat outside the Masters Oil Company on West Main in Norman. The business said numerous people stopped to take pictures beside the statue, at least while it had its head. The 700-pound statue has been there for 5 years, but Friday morning the shop owner noticed that the head had been sawed off. Police have fingerprints, but the shop owner hopes that whoever cut the dinosaur's head off will bring it back.
Uh-huh. All right.
What kind of dinosaur?
It says a Sinclair dinosaur. I'm not sure what that means. There's a
What's
photograph
a Sinclair?
There.
Oh, wait a minute. It's a brontosaurus.
Looks like a brontosaurus.
Wait a minute. Are we talking about the... and this was outside of a... what was the business that it was
an
outside
oil
of? Yeah, well, that's
company?
The Sinclair. It's the Sinclair dinosaur, you know, the Sinclair Oil
it's
Company.
A brontosaurus. This
they have a dinosaur.
This is actually incredibly sad.
No, it's a mascot. It's Sinclair Oil. And you gotta, in terms of mascots, I mean, it's either sort of great or sort of creepy.
It's very creepy.
That their mascot is, in fact, one of the things that dies and decays and turns into petrochemicals. Oh, that's just sad.
Have you seen the movie Baby? Like the weird heartwarming dinosaur movie from the early 80s.
Yes.
Yeah, where
I
they
forgot all
where
about
baby's
that.
Mom gets killed a la Bambi, and then they have to take baby back to his family.
Oh God, why did you remind me of that?
Oh God, this reminds me of it. It's like baby's mom got decapitated by hunters.
You know, the brontosaurus is one of those things. Did you see that they have now removed two of the dinosaurs from my childhood? And they said that it's like how they just decided that Pluto isn't a planet again, which
we'd
gone back and forth like 9 different times on whether or not Pluto's a planet. First, they take away the brontosaurus by saying that it never actually existed. There was like some guy who got fossils from bag A, like mixed up with fossils going to truck B. And that back at the lab, there was like some sort of a kooky mix-up, and that they created like a sort of a basilope thing that doesn't really exist. So there apparently was no brontosaurus. And then like last week, they're saying there's no triceratops. Doesn't exist.
No.
That's a lie.
You see? That's my reaction.
I love the triceratops.
I don't think I could live in a world without triceratops.
Everybody likes the triceratops. And they're saying, no. And apparently that was just a thing where it was another version of some previously extant dinosaur. It was a mistake where they misidentified something else they're thinking as a triceratops. Which doesn't make any sense because then you wonder, what about all the crap you found like since you came up with the Triceratops 200 years ago?
Like the Megasaurus and the Ultrasaurus and all the other sauruses?
Well, and like everything else they found that was a Triceratops or so they thought. Like, what was that? Was it the – it's like I think with the Brontosaurus. Like, does that mean that everything they found subsequent to that, that they said, well, this is also a Brontosaurus, was also some kind of a mistake?
I refuse to accept this Triceratops thing. It's like the second and third Matrix movies. I just refuse to accept that
this exists. I'm with Don on this.
No, you grow up believing certain things, even if you don't totally understand them. And then when they're taken away, you just feel that it's like when the Catholic Church decreed that that hell might not actually be an actual place. And you say, well, what? Well, that doesn't make any – come on. You know, there's just certain pillars of your belief that get taken away from you. So, all right. Well, there you go. I had something else to say about blah, 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 Sinclair. I got nothing. Here's Don Taylor.
I hadn't decided what to tell you yet, so – here we go. An 11-year-old California boy has been has quite a story to tell as the new school year begins. He got stuck in a chimney for 2 hours just one day before school started.
His arms full of presents.
Home video and pictures Small captured no the dramatic rescue of Matthew McCammon by Woodlake, California firefighters. Crews used an air chisel to bust a hole in the back of the chimney to free the boy. "I looked black," Matthew said. "My whole face was black. I didn't look like myself.
I had so much more style and soul."
Matthew's stepfather, Roger Philpott, warned him not to go down the chimney. He said, "Guys, I'm stuck," Philpott said.
This story is filled with phrases that sound like something they're not supposed to be. All of these phrases seem to have second and third and fourth meanings that are probably not intended by the writer.
Don't go down the chimney.
"I'm stuck in here. Don't go down the chimney. I looked black."
Air chisel. Matthew's mom, Chrissy Philpott, was grateful to rescue crews. She initially feared the worst. "He's just hollering, 'Mama, please help me, I'm scared,' and crying," she said. Matthew's right elbow, shoulders, and knees are a bit sore, but he was cleared by a doctor to attend his first day of middle school. "Hopefully he learned his lesson," his mother said. He told me last night and this morning he would not go down the chimney again.
All right, well, let's back up. First of all,
I'm amazed these people have a chimney.
I don't know. Well, I got two different questions about this, at least. First of all, and I know the story didn't really explain this, so maybe somebody in the room understands. What is an air chisel? I mean, I get the idea that it's a thing that chips away pieces
You don't have your own air chisel?
I guess I've
I thought everybody these days had their own air chisel.
Well, I'm not in the income bracket of some, Kelly Clark.
I have one in my purse right now.
What is an air chisel as opposed to like a regular chisel? Or like, is it like a jackhammer? And if so, why would you not just use a jackhammer?
I believe it's a handheld jackhammer. It's a small jackhammer.
So it's not that it actually uses like, in my head.
Well, jackhammers use air. Yeah, they use air compressors.
Okay, yeah, but it's an air compressor. So it's pneumatic, basically.
Right.
But in my head, I was imagining some like hyper compressed like blast of air or something that like.
That it's the air that chiseled out something because it was so.
You were thinking like a sandblaster thing, only a chisel.
I was thinking
that
there was.
Controlled bursts.
I was thinking there was something. Yeah, like a. Exactly. Like a sandblaster, but that they were using some burst of air to sort of free him up or to create a pocket of, you know, to do something
around. A lot of damage with an air chisel.
It would not be.
Well, see, and then I immediately wanted one.
Because
I was thinking about all the cool things I could do with such a weapon, tool. And it's okay, but now, but in the space of like 30 seconds, it's been created in my mind and then taken away because now I've just apparently
like the Triceratops.
Like the Triceratops. Bastards.
Your life is just an endless array of disappointment and heartache, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I came to that conclusion
of disappointment and heartache.
Long ago. I'm glad that you're here with us now, finally. And then my second thing is, was this in the States or was this elsewhere?
This was in California.
How is it that he got into the chimney? Because don't they build chimneys now that like you can't anywhere, like you can't get into them, like either from the top or the bottom? I thought that they had grates or something put over them, or it's like they had those helmety things that went down, the sort of triangular covers on them. A guy couldn't. Decide to get jammed into one of them.
The story does not clarify exactly how or why he entered the chimney.
These things never really have the explication that you're looking for. All right, here's Don Taylor.
Lynn Rosenthal, a college English professor from Manhattan, said three cops forcibly ejected her from an Upper West Side Starbucks on Sunday after she got into a dispute after refusing to place her order by the coffee chain's rules, as reported by the New York Post. Professor Rosenthal, who is in her 60s, asked for a toasted multigrain bagel and became enraged with the barista at the franchise, followed up by inquiring, "Do you want butter or cheese?" "I just wanted a multigrain bagel," Professor Rosenthal said. "I refused to say without butter or cheese. When you go to Burger King, you don't have to list the six things you don't want. Linguistically, it's stupid, and I'm a stickler for correct English." Professor Rosenthal said she also ran into trouble in the past for refusing to employ the chain's stilted lexicon, balking at ordering a tall or a venti from the menu, or specifying no whip. Instead, she insists on making a pest of herself by ordering small or large. Sunday's breakfast bagel tussle heated up when the barista told the professor that he would not serve her unless she specified whether she wanted butter or cheese or neither. "I yelled, 'I want my multigrain bagel,'" Professor Rosenthal said.
Awesome.
The barista said, "You're not going to get anything unless you say butter or cheese."
Please tell me this ends with the cop showing up and breaking her ribs.
Tasering.
The bagel brouhaha escalated until the manager called the police and responding officers ordered her to leave.
Oh, they should have maced her right there at the counter.
Threatening to arrest her if she went back inside.
Look, and you know me. You know I'm an anal retentive jerk about language sometimes. But I mean, seriously, get the stick out of your ass. First of all, because she's wrong, incidentally. She is incorrect. I find fault with her claim that it's a matter of incorrect linguistics. First of all, could you read me? I can either read it myself. I don't mean to treat you like the court transcriptist or whatever. The court reporter. I say, can you read back to me what the defendant just said?
This woman is a sour ass. I'm sorry.
Let's see. Professor Rosenthal, who is a humorless prig of a woman, who is in her 60s, asked for a, that's my constitutionally protected opinion, by the way, asked for a toasted multigrain bagel. I should know that they're missing a comma here. And became enraged when the barista at the franchise. She doesn't balk by saying barista. You know, she could, you know, why? It's a real word, as it's meant to be, by the way. On Columbus Avenue, 82nd Street, followed up by inquiring of her, "Do you want butter or cheese?" She said, "I refuse to say butter without cheese. Linguistically, it's stupid. You don't have to list." Okay, but they weren't. In other words, it is not a reflexive statement. The implication is not that the bagel comes with butter or cheese unless she doesn't say that. They are offering to upsell her, which is not the same thing as making her clarify the lack of something. Yep. So she's incorrect when she makes that complaint. The barista was not implying that unless she said otherwise, she would get those things, which is what this the horrible woman seems to be claiming.
It sounds like
a bagel does come at Starbucks or any place. A bagel usually comes with butter, cream cheese, or jelly of some sort. That is your topping that comes with the bagel. You would have to specify if you didn't want any of your toppings.
I don't.
Because it's a free, it's the thing that comes with it.
I don't think that's true because, and I don't really know because I've never worked at a Starbucks, but I think you've worked at a Starbucks.
Yeah,
right?
but
the bagels come out of the bag. Yeah. They're not covered in cheese.
Well, we didn't really do much in the way of
bagels. But isn't the cream cheese or butter free with the bagel? Isn't it expected? Like, if I went to a Starbucks and I ordered a bagel and then they gave me no cream cheese, I'd be like, where's my cream cheese? How am I supposed to eat my bagel?
I don't think anyone gives you cream cheese for free anymore.
I think you got to ask for it. Yeah. I don't think it's a given that you're going to get that. Plus everybody's got some goddamn food allergy or some nonsense that they're talking about.
I don't think
they put anything on there.
Woman is a shrewish.
Oh no, she can get
jackass.
Bent. No, she can eat a full bag of it because
I will say on some level though I understand where she's coming from. I would not behave that way, but I understand where she's coming from because I used to have this issue when they first started making salads at McDonald's and you'd drive through and you would order, and each specific salad comes with its own salad dressing. Mm-hmm. But you would order the salad and say, I would like the chicken Caesar salad with the grilled chicken. And then they would say, what kind of dressing do you want with that? Caesar dressing. And it's like, stop asking me that.
Well, but you know the reason they're doing that is because they're working off a script. Yeah. That's the thing. It's because they're not even really listening
to you. But it's still infuriating because it's like if you set up a menu situation where you have the Southwest chicken thing comes with ranch. The Caesar salad dressing comes with Caesar. That's what makes it a Caesar salad. So to ask me, what kind of dressing do you want with the Caesar salad? Well, so if I wasn't getting Caesar dressing, it would be a different salad.
Well, but see, first of all, I don't think this is
McDonald's.
You're McDonald's. B, I don't think I knew until just now that there was an actual Caesar dressing. I think.
Are you kidding me?
No, I had no.
No air chisels, no Caesar salad.
If you had asked me,
world do you live in?
If you had 60 seconds ago, if you'd asked me what made a Caesar salad, I don't think I could have told you. I don't think I could have explained the difference between what is a Caesar salad and what is a non-Caesar salad.
Now, granted, the McDonald's Caesar salad is still not a correct Caesar salad because it is not a real Caesar salad. It's only romaine. And generally has some sort of anchovy.
Yeah, this is the source of
anchovy, raw egg, Worcestershire sauce, Parmesan.
I think we've identified the source of your problem with most of the world right now. You know too many things, Dawn. You've seen too much in your life. You're too smart. And so, yeah. I don't know. You got to figure that maybe there's some dick who just shows up. You know, I'd like a Caesar salad with a little blue cheese or something.
You know that happens.
That's why they ask.
McDonald's. That's because they've made it part of the script because it's hampered them so many times because somebody has come up to the window and been like, oh, but I wanted that Caesar with ranch that they've started putting it in the script.
I'll guarantee you that's why.
Mean, there's a guy in the text box right now says, I always get my Caesar salad with blue cheese dressing.
Aha.
Like, well, I'll tell you right now, sir, you're not getting
a Caesar salad.
No, but if he gets blue, because it doesn't stop being a Caesar salad if you add another thing to it.
Not unless you add the blue cheese on top of the Caesar
dressing.
That's
what I'm saying. If you add something to it, it doesn't stop being a Caesar salad.
But he's saying no. He's subbing the Caesar salad dressing out and putting blue cheese in, which makes it a green salad with blue cheese.
God, we've all become this woman. Jesus.
It's like if you order fettuccine Alfredo and you decide to put marinara sauce on it instead, it is no longer fettuccine Alfredo.
Now, why is that?
Because it's marinara.
And not Alfredo sauce.
It's the sauce.
This is a whole thing where
sauce
my brain feels like it's turning in and out.
That said, it's still a Starbucks. Like, how sad does your life have to be that this is something you're going to stick to your guns on?
Well, I mean,
I'm thinking perhaps there were other things going on in her life that were enraging her that she wasn't expressing
but
properly.
I like that I think the reason this is so great is that she has been a constant thorn in their side. That this is not the first time that she has berated them. It's like if I worked at Starbucks and I had, I just had this regular customer that was just an ass and, like, constantly was being mean about things. Like,
oh, that's,
I would use the bagel,
that's just
the bagel
working
fiasco
at Starbucks.
Yeah, like, there, of course they're going to use it as an excuse to get her out of the shop. I mean, this is their shining moment where, like, they can be like, you know what?
Here's
you're 86.
And here's the thing. Don't get me wrong. I am the first person to complain about bad customer service.
Oh, yeah.
Because there is, and I don't mean to sound like everybody's dad about this. You know, I sound like a hopeless square when I say things like this, but there is no excuse for bad customer service, if only for your own self-interest. Like, you got to pay the rent, which means you got to have a job, which means you can't get fired, which means whether you like it or not, if some guy's giving you money, that's what makes our country work. Guy gives you money to do some stuff. You know what? You do the stuff. And if the stuff includes being polite to jackasses, you do it. You know, that's just the thing. It's like, you know, I take it as a sort of point of pride that even when I had jobs I loathed, that I sucked it up and I was polite to people who didn't deserve it. Now, that being said, so I hate bad customer service. That being said,
but
there's people in this world who just have it coming. And this woman who goes in and just makes all – here's the thing. I won't even say being a barista because that sort of – that implies just Starbucks. Working at a coffee shop, and I don't mean this as a knock, is in many ways the worst job imaginable in the food service industry. And here's why. Because all day long, all day, every day, you are dealing with an endless chain of people before they have had their coffee. And someone who hasn't had their coffee is a dick.
But in Portland, though, it can also get you laid.
Well, then that's true. So there's perks.
I will also say this, having worked at Starbucks, there's a certain amount – people are grumpy, but people are actually, I think, a little bit nicer to you because they do really want their coffee.
You're the dealer.
And they're grateful that you're giving it to them. I was always aware when I was working at Starbucks that I was just a couple of rungs above, you know, Carl's Jr. But at the same time, though, I think that the customers at who go to coffee places – tend to be a lot nicer to baristas and overall and are much more grateful to them.
Because they're their friend that they see every morning and you give me the thing that I love.
I was going to say.
Thank you. It's not like they're giving them, you know.
You girls know what I'm talking about. They're nice to you because you got something they want. I mean, that's really the thing. I mean, really, it's like, you know, because you got the coffee and you're like, yeah, no, it's a great morning. And meanwhile, their eyes are just sort of fixed on the back shelf, you know, just sort of narrowing, you know, to pinpoints, like waiting to see if it's done. The other thing about a humorless crone, Professor Lynn Rosenthal, and I mean, a college English professor from Manhattan, which I think tells us all we need to know. Right here, she says, instead she insists because she's, quote, a freak for linguistics. That's actually not the quote, but she's all like bent on, you know, being linguistically correct. She insists on making a pest of herself by ordering a, quote, small or large, end quote, a cup of Joe, which you'd think that if she was being linguistically pure, she wouldn't order a small or a large, since those aren't really sizes anyway. Those are relative sizes.
She'd do an 8-ounce or a 12-ounce cup.
Or a 20-ounce. And 20? Italian? Anyone? Venti.
Venti.
So shut your head. All right, Jesus, for the love of God. We don't have time to do this now because Dawn's got to skedaddle here in a few and do a show called Ham-Fisted Radio, which you can hear at pdx.fm. You know, if I was not so short, which means we won't get to the top five and so forth, it doesn't matter because we've had this scintillating and tantalizing conversation about bagels in the English language, which I mean sincerely. There's no irony there. I could have conversations like this all day long. Where I just, you know, talk about either customer service or the Oxford comma or some confluence of both. What I would do if we had infinite amounts of time today is I would go into this article that I pulled, I don't know, like, it seems like years ago. We haven't had a chance to do it, and it would have been a perfect follow-up right now, so maybe we'll do it tomorrow. But there was an editorial written by a barista, which is, and that's like Italian for something, isn't it? And a barista, that's a real word. It's an Italian for...
person who makes your coffee.
It is like a preparer, server, something.
Sure.
So that's another thing that people think is a fake word that's not. There was a barista who wrote an editorial for, I believe, the Los Angeles Times, and it was called Six Things You Do That Irritate Your Barista. And it was a sort of open letter to the customer base. It was like six things that like you do that bug the holy hell out of me. And she actually opened it by saying that she believed that she was paid a fair wage, especially at Starbucks, which has, you know, by all accounts, treats their employees very well. She said, they pay me, so I do what I'm told. And that includes being polite, even when the following six things happen. And it was like six things that customers do, you know, that irritate the living bejesus out of them. So maybe we'll get to that tomorrow and whatnot. All of this merriment and amusement is made possible by a passel of folks, including, but not limited to, Mr. Michael Beatty. And he's the proprietor of a local business, speaking of our proud American way of capitalism, called The Cleaning Solution. And I'm going to give you this phone number right up top so you can write it down, because you know, you may not need it today, may not need it tomorrow, maybe not next week. But at the moment when you need to have your carpet cleaned or your upholstery or your tile, anything in your house where your feet are tracking, because it's not a thing you plan to to do, right? I mean, you accept that there's some normal wear and tear, but it's not like on your agenda you sort of like go to lunch, pick up dry cleaning, track filth into home, break for high tea, you know, watch television. It's always a thing that you just sort of, you look back and you go, wait a minute, and then you do the double and then the triple take of double take looking at the carpet to see if you have in fact tracked some sort of detritus on the rug.
And then
you do, kombucha. And then you do the thing of lifting up your shoe and going, ah, Christ, for the love of it. And then you just go and you put your, and then you go walk back outside. Because then you're in the middle of the rug, right? And you either got to walk back to the porch so you can take your shoes off, and then you got to do your stocking feet back into the house, or you got to do what Don says yesterday, where you continue the problem by walking down one of the well-worn grooves in your carpet to get to like the bathroom, where you can then take the shoes off and then hose them off inside the shower or something. Either way, you got a bunch of crap going into your rug, it's mud or whatever, and then it just dries, and then it falls to the bottom, and then it just gets sort of a dingy grayness. So the time will come when you need to have all that taken care of. And when that time comes, you will be glad that I gave you this number and then you wrote it down right now. Now. With a pen. All right. 971. Still no pen. Okay. It's in the drawer under the microwave. That's where everybody keeps their pens. Okay. 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. The cleaning solution, Mr. Michael Beatty. Please tell him you heard about it right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Let's do a couple more of these, and then we will bid you adieu for today.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Oh, let's do the religious nutcase watch.
Shall we? Can we please? And then sing and dance. This is your religious nutcase watch for Wednesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Your religious nutcase watch for Wednesday.
Kentucky's Creation Museum, a facility devoted to the belief that Earth and the universe are only 6,000 years old, is usually viewed in one of two ways: a fun place where fundamentalist Christians can go to reaffirm their beliefs, or as the epicenter of a worldview ripe for mockery by scientists. Now, a new analysis argues that for people already alienated by religious fundamentalism, the museum can be a painful reminder of discrimination and isolation. The study, presented Sunday at the American Sociological Association meeting in Atlanta, took place over three in-depth visits to the museum over a year and a half. Bernadette Barton, a professor of sociology at Morehead State University in Kentucky, toured exhibits, attended museum lectures, observed museum guests, and led a student field trip to the museum. In her analysis, she argues that despite the museum's mission to reach out to believers and skeptics alike, the Creation Museum can be uncomfortable for non-fundamentalist visitors. Young Earth creationism is the belief that everything in the biblical book of Genesis is literally true. God created the universe in six 24-hour days 6,000 years ago. All mankind came from Adam and Eve. And the Garden of Eden is a lost paradise where humans and dinosaurs coexisted peacefully. The Creation Museum, opened in 2007, put its own brand of scientific explanations of creationism alongside exhibits of Adam and Eve, dinosaurs with humans, and Noah building his ark. One exhibit, Graffiti Alley, purports to show what happens when mankind abandons young Earth creationism. These consequences include the birth control pill, abortion, divorce, murder, and gay marriage. Anyway, apparently not every visitor to the museum comes away with the with feelings of joy and happiness. The museum uses guard dogs, employs strict warnings to people. A lesbian couple became paranoid about being near or touching each other while they were visiting, afraid they would be found out. And
I guess my question is, why would you be going to this museum if you were, I don't know, let's say this couple or anyone else who was presumably not really interested in learning about the intricacies of creationism?
Oh, I would totally go to that.
I mean, I'd go to it too, but I would not then go to it and go, my God, but hold on, this is all lunacy.
I feel uncomfortable here.
That's the reason you would go, right?
I think her point was that they purport to want to spread the word of creation. They want to sell you on creationism, but when you arrive, there are signs that warn you in several places that you could be asked to leave at any time. There are security guards with dogs who like come and walk around and like circle you if you look at all suspicious.
This sounds like the best place ever. I feel like we have to go there.
You are making me.
Where is this at?
This is my new.
This is in Kentucky.
Unsurprisingly, I guess I should have just defaulted to that. So if it was like a day's drive from here or less, I would absolutely go.
The reservation confirmation notes that museum staff reserve the right to kick you or your group off the property if you were not honest about the purpose of your visit.
See, that's awesome. This sounds like a place that I need to learn more about. There's probably some local equivalent or some equivalent that is closer to Oregon than this. And I'm going to go there, by God.
And do a – we could do a remote.
I got the best idea, though, when you're talking about this. We'll go out on this notion for today. I have the greatest idea for a reality TV show. There ought to be some reality show where a guy is tasked with – wait for it. Anyone? Building an ark. Guy's got to build an ark. He's got to gather two of every creature on Earth. He's got to put them in the ark, and then he's got to stay afloat like in Lake Michigan for 40 days and 40 nights or whatever it is. Am I conflating it with somebody else? No, it's 40 days and 40 nights. So that's the thing.
No, that's how much it rained.
Right. And for 40 days. Right. That's what I'm saying. He's got to then stay in the lake for 40 days and 40 nights.
He's got to hose him down.
He's
got to replicate.
He's just got to stay on the water, away from land, in a boat with his family, presumably also crazy, or just desperate for attention, and all the animals for four. He's got
to. Would it have to be all the animals, or just a really large representative sampling?
No, all.
Well, I'd say
there's a lot of animals.
I would say that it has to be however many he is capable of gathering, because that's what Noah was told.
The more he gathers, the more money he gets at the end.
That's true.
Yes,
absolutely. And then he gets extra bonus points for challenges where he makes his own clothes, grows a beard,
and if he can figure out what a cubit is. So that. Yes, you are exactly. That is the cherry that was missing from the Noah Sunday. That's it. And so there's no, when you say how many animals, well, what did God say? God said, look, you got to get two of everything. Go. And Noah, well, I, crap. All right, fine. Lot. You know, and then it's and then they just went at it. So,
you know, you could do actually the whole series could be like people who have to just do biblical challenges. Like you could have like 1 week they have to drive moneylenders from the temple.
Ooh, you could make fashionistas make coats of many colors.
Oh, I like what we're saying. But then there's the whole awkward moment where Lot's daughters have to get him drunk and have sex with him.
Well.
All right. Well, in any event.
That brings us back to Sarah Palin's Alaska.
I call dibs on Sodom. I'm telling you right now, that is a show. And you know who could do this? God damn, I'm brilliant. You know who could do this show is the Discovery Channel. Because it's sort of – because without being like a ripoff of Mythbusters, like that Smash Lab thing, which, you know, that was just like a bad Mythbusters knockoff. This is – and the great thing about it is that it like – it is a sort of Rorschach program in that believers would look at it and they would say, all right, see, you're going to see that it's – because, you know, there are intelligent – I mean presumably learned, educated men who spend millions of dollars every year on Mount Ararat in Turkey looking for Noah's Ark because they think it's a real thing. They believe it's literally true. So believers would say, well, now, you know, we're going to recreate one of the greatest stories that our Lord told us in the Holy Book. And then non-believers are going to say, ah, you're going to see why this is crap. Watch, he'll never be – he doesn't even know what a cubit is. He'll never figure it out. And plus, it's got the architecture thing. It's got this sort of what is that, the show where they're in a junkyard and they have to build stuff? Like Junkyard Wars, I think.
Junkyard Wars.
It's got that. It's got the zoology thing. It's got the construction thing. It's got the, you know, the sort of Made in America, Ratzenberger.
Cute animals, Meerkat Manor thing going on.
And then it's got a competition angle to it. Plus, it's got the family dynamic because it's Noah, his wife, Lot, and
Steve.
Ted. and Lot and whoever his other son was. Ham. Lot and Ham and Noah and his wife, and then Lot and Ham's wives. So you got the family bickering and that you never like me anyway, and I can't believe she's wearing these shoes and the blah, blah, blah. And
meanwhile, they have to figure out how to keep the squirrels separate from the lions.
And then you just say, look, we're not going to replicate a flood as such, but you're going to have to just be adrift. So we're going to stick you in the middle of some huge body of water, and you're just going to float there within certain parameters, and then for 40 days and 40 nights, and then that is where you put like a live webcam so you can watch it on television, but then you can also get the Big Brother thing of actually watching them real time during the 40 days and 40 nights. It pays for itself.
The sanitation.
Could we do this in Portland? Is this a thing we could replicate in Portland? I got to think about this. Seriously, I know
we could
put
him on a barge in the middle of the Willamette River, sure. Yeah.
Yes. See? Right there. Fine, whatever. That's, you know, I'm just going to call that Mark, what's his name? Gotcha, the created survivor. I'm going to sell him Burnett. That idea today. Mark Burnett.
He's also producing Sarah Palin's Alaska.
Is he really?
Of course
yes,
he is.
Yes, he is.
See, how can you hate that guy? Good for him. You know what? You know, if a fool offers you his or her money, you take it, baby. You take it and run with it. Excellent. Well done. All right. Kelly Clark, reader in print in the Willamette Week or online at WWeek.com. New issue on stands right now featuring
right now.
The kombucha story, Lady Gaga, many other things. Anything
all
else of note people want to know about in the new issue?
Basically, our open source software community could save America. We could save our healthcare, but we're totally going to screw it up.
All right. Well done. Well, you know how that story ends. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Peter Carlin from The Oregonian and Friday, Portland blogger Food Carts. Mr. Brett Burmeister will be here. So and so forth. All right. We want to thank our guest, Kelly Clark, for joining us today. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the News Network's desk is Dawn Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, and our chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Wednesday, August 18th, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, after a brief musical interlude, today's truncated Legion of News will encore, followed by an encore of this radio program. Thanks for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.